Welcome to episode 44 of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you, as always, by DragonMount.com. We're proud to present to you a live interview with Brandon Sanderson, who, as you all know, is the author who has chosen to complete A Memory of Light. Brandon graciously agreed to give the Fourth Age an interview, and Jesse and I were fortunate enough to be able to catch up with Brandon live and in person while he was in Los Angeles on his book signing tour for the third volume of his Mistborn series, Hero of Ages. Joining us for the interview were Mark and Andrew Gelos, who participated by a conference call in a question and answer session. We had a lot of questions for Brandon, both those that we generated and those that came from listeners, and so we really hope that you enjoy Brandon's unique and fascinating insights into the Wheel of Time, and I think that you'll agree that the last book of the series is in very good hands, and we're very excited about this interview. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Here we go.
Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone. I'm Andrew Gelos, and with us today we have Mark.
Hello, everyone. Good to be back.
And we also have with us Jesse.
Hello, everybody.
And I'm Virginia. And our special guest today is Brandon Sanderson.
Hello.
So we're very happy to welcome Brandon to the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Andrew?
Yes. In your eulogy to Mr. Jordan, you stated, "Eventually, I found myself reacting against the Wheel of Time in my writing, not because I disliked Jordan, but because I felt he'd captured the epic quest story so well that I wanted to explore new ground. As his books chronicled sweeping scenes of motion set behind characters traveling all across this world, I started to set mine in single cities. As his stories focused on peasants who became kings, I began to tell stories about kings who became peasants. One of those was Elantris. With that particular thought in mind, or what is the experience like to not only get behind the mind frame of a character in the Wheel of Time as you write them, but also getting behind RJ's mind frame, seeing as the style of writing is somewhat counter to what you are more used to doing?
Well, it's a... I don't know, it's a difficult question to answer because I don't feel that it's that hard. Let me explain myself. I was writing that eulogy long before I knew that I would be tapped for this. I was just talking about my experiences, and really what I was trying to capture was the concept of the whole shoulders of giants idea. That I felt that, you know, Robert Jordan, he's the great master storyteller and quest teller in fantasy for my generation. I didn't grow up reading Tolkien. I didn't like Tolkien when I was first given Tolkien. I grew up reading Eye of the World and these sorts of things. And, of course, the very first few books that I tried writing long before I got published were in a similar vein. They were the epic quest in the same style of Robert Jordan. And so I did try that, and I enjoyed writing those books. But as I was writing them, often I would just get this feeling of, why am I retreading this ground when it's been done so well? I didn't want to write books, in other words, that I would have to say, well, before you read mine, you should read Robert Jordan's because it's better, and if that makes sense. I wanted to be able to write books and say, this adds something. This takes things in a different direction. Of course, I'd still probably recommend Robert Jordan's works before my own, but at least this way, I wasn't trying to do the exact same thing. I saw a lot of people trying to publish during that era, the late 90s, early 2000s, who were essentially just trying the same thing, I didn't enjoy reading a lot of them because I felt, if we have the Wheel of Time, why do we need this? And so that's really just what I was trying to capture. Now, looking and writing in the Wheel of Time universe, I mean, I've read Eye of the World 9 times now. I'm very familiar with this story, and my first inclinations when I started writing were to do something like this. I think the hero's journey is very much a part of all of our souls. It's part of our collective unconscious, if you will. I think it's a very important story. It speaks and it resonates very much within us. And so I don't think that aspect of it is hard, looking at it and saying, wow, now I get to actually, I get to do this archetypal, wonderful story, as opposed to having to struggle to find a way to do something that's different, that's still interesting. And so in some ways, it's actually easier. Now, in a lot of other ways, which we'll probably get into in the podcast, it's much, much harder than writing my own books. But in that one little aspect, I think that it's more natural.
That's really amazing to me, because it never occurred to me that somebody didn't grow up reading Tolkien, and I guess I'm showing my age there a little bit, because that was obviously the one to start with when I was in high school and so forth. One quick note, guys, be really careful about making noise, because it's picking up everything that you do on the call. So we're getting
I'm sorry, but I decided to tidy up a little bit before I could hit the music.
We can't see your messy room, so that's
no,
all right.
We don't care. But it's picking up everything that you do and when you're on the phone, just like anything on a phone call.
Yeah, I'll make sure to hit mute next time I see him leave the room, just in case he makes noise again.
And Curb Lanfear, if she's there. No, you're at the bookstore, that's right.
Yeah, I'm in the cash room. Right.
Okay. Good name for a cat. Very appropriate.
I thought so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess one of my questions was that I'm an artist myself, although I'm more of a visual artist rather than a writer. And I think that any creative person, whether an artist or a writer, has some personal method of trying to get into creative methods. What works for you as a self-described compulsive writer? Do you even need to try and get into it?
Yeah, it really depends on the day. The easiest way for me to get into it, there are really two easy ways. One is to turn on the right music. Usually a good soundtrack, or it depends on the mood I need to be in, but that'll start to put me in the mood. Something else I do is read writing I'd done the day before. Or when I'm working on Wheel of Time, grab a section of Jim's writing from the same character and start reading through that. And that'll start to put me into it pretty quickly. You train yourself to do this. Being a writer is like, you have to learn to be both an artist and a business person, I often say. And the artist just wants to write when the mood strikes them. And the business person wants to eat. And so you've got to find a balance between that. And so you've got to learn to train yourself to get into the mindset where the artist can actually create. And that's hard for some people. It was pretty natural to me because I spent a lot of my early years working a graveyard shift at a hotel. And I would get to work, and there was nothing to do but write. I would make sure that there was nothing to do. I would just have to sit there and twiddle my thumbs for 5 hours from midnight to 5 a.m. And so instead, I would say, okay, I might as well use this time. I didn't bring any video games or anything, so I would start writing. And I learned to put myself into that mood. Otherwise, I would have been just bored out of my skull.
That's a really good notion. I do something similar when I sit down to paint. I make myself sit there in front of the easel, and I can't take phone calls. I can't go anywhere else. I can't play video games. So I have nothing else to do.
Remove the distraction.
Yeah. Either that or clean out the paint box for 5 hours. You don't have any hard time getting into Robert Jordan's voice or his famous line?
Well, let me answer that simple question with a very complicated answer. When I first was offered this, I spent a long time thinking about how I would approach it. I've never written in someone else's world before. I was really never interested in doing so. For really any other author but Robert Jordan, I would have said no. But these books have been a part of my life for so many years, and I was so worried about the state of the last book that there's no way I could say no to this. And so I sat and thought for a long while, how would I approach this? And when I was reading through the series again in the earlier part of the year, I was really thinking about this. Do I want to try to imitate Jim's voice or not? The decision I eventually came to, and it's a distinction that makes sense in my head, I don't know if it'll make sense to anyone else, is that I do not want to try and imitate Jim's voice. I want to try and write appropriately to the Wheel of Time, if that makes sense. I want to adapt my style to the Wheel of Time, but I don't want to sit down and say, try to make it sound exactly like Jim would, because I think that if I did that, it would turn into parody. I don't think, honestly, I can write that way. I can't sit there and say, each word, would Jim write this word? But I can say, what about my style is different from what feels right for the Wheel of Time, and how can I change my style? I came to the two conclusions, that there were two main areas I needed to work and change and adapt. As an author, I mean, as a painter, you probably realize this. You can paint in different styles if you want to. For my own books, I've chosen a certain style, so to speak. It's not the only one I've ever experimented with, and it's not the only one I've written in. In fact, if you read my young adult book, you'll find that I chose a completely different style that feels very different for those. And so when I said, how can I approach the Wheel of Time, I decided I needed to be more descriptive. That was the number one. My own books, I like description, but I'm not nearly descriptive enough to give the same feel that we love from the Wheel of Time. The second thing I decided I needed to do was step about just one shade closer into narrative, into the viewpoints. If you'll read Jim's work, one slight difference between his work and my work is, this is a simple thing, it's much deeper than this, but he'll use exclamation points in narrative and I don't. And that's a hint of something a little bit larger, that he has a much more untrustworthy narrator than I do. When you're in a viewpoint in a Wheel of Time book, you are so close to that character that the narrative and thoughts, the line becomes blurred. Each paragraph he writes really could be in the first person almost and put in italics instead to make it thoughts. And occasionally he jumps into thoughts directly, but that shift is slight. In mine, the shift is a little bit stronger. My narrator isn't quite as untrustworthy. I'm showing the world through their eyes, but I'm not saying anything necessarily untrue. And then when I jump into thoughts, it's a much more distinctive jump. And that's why you'll see me jumping into thoughts more often than you see Jim jumping into thoughts. It's a little balancing thing. Again, it's hard to explain to people who haven't written a lot themselves, but that was a shift I felt I needed to make in order to make it feel right. I think that'll make the characters feel like themselves, assuming I can get them, get the voice right. But I'm not really too worried about that. Having read the books for so many years, writing in a lot of these characters' voices feels like it feels like hanging out with friends from my childhood. And then changing the descriptions to match the Wheel of Time. I think those two things will evoke the right feel. Now, I will say that I think that readers very close to Jim's writing will be able to study the book, and they will be able to pick out which parts I wrote and Jim wrote, I'm pretty sure. I would hope that people would wait to do that until after they've read through it the first time. I think it would be a futile effort to try and imitate Jim to that extent. He was a master storyteller. We don't have anyone else like him. I am certainly not as good a writer as he was. I hope that I'm a pretty decent one, and I do feel I'm the best choice for this. But, it's how can you imitate Da Vinci? I mean, it's like we've got half of a Da Vinci painting left over, and with having that guide, I think I can do a really good job of finishing it off and giving you the painting as it's supposed to look. But if you really look at it and analyze the brush strokes, you will find, I think, where my style is and where his style is. But hopefully, like I said, that's something that you really have to look at to determine. And you'll read through the book and enjoy it first as Jim would want you to. And then after the fact, look back and say, okay, now let's pick it apart, because that's what we all do, right? And let's see what we can find out and decide, is this chapter, is this paragraph, is this sentence even Jim's or is it Brandon's?
I'm just so glad that the book's going to be finished, honestly. That was a huge worry for me. I have to say, it was very selfish when I realized that he passed away, because almost the second thought in my mind was, oh my God, we're never going to know what happened.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it felt that way. Me, I didn't actually feel that way because I know publishing too much, and I knew there's no way this book is not going to get finished. Now, if Harriet had not wanted it to be finished, then it might have been 20 years before it happened. But it would have happened eventually. Someone would have done it. I was scared for how it would turn out when someone finally did that. I mean, someone eventually wrote a sequel to Gone with the Wind, right? And a lot of the true fans of Gone with the Wind hate that book, the sequel. I was worried that book 12 would be that. And so, I hope that it won't be. Writing it, I don't think it will be. But you know, that was my worry.
Andrew, I know you have to go. Do you have other questions?
My other question was this. I can tell, obviously, just from speaking with you that, you know, you are an amazingly large fan of the series, like I think all of us here are. I would kind of guess, because, and this is how I think myself, that when reading through the series, you know, well before book 12 was going to come out, you kind of had an idea of where you thought certain characters would kind of go and what sort of actions they'd end up taking as the overall story progressed. We know you can't reveal anything about the plot of A Memory of Light, but if you can tell us this, since you know as much as anyone is going to know right now, which characters most meet your expectations and which ones surprised you?
Oh, wow.
Well, that's a book in itself.
Yeah. Answering this question is also very dangerous because I don't want to bias people in any way about the book or make them worry. Let me give you an example of caveat here. When Jason from Dragonmount first interviewed me back in, it must have been December of last year, he asked me a very simple, innocent question. Who's your favorite character? So I responded, my favorite character is Perrin. He's been my favorite character for a long time. I just enjoy reading about him. And the moment I mentioned that, you know, most people who read that interview are like, oh, great, that's fine. But there was a group who said, that means he must hate the other one. Or he's not going to treat this character the right way because he didn't mention this character. Or he obviously doesn't understand Nynaeve. Or, I mean, it just, and so anytime I say anything like this, I risk ruining the experience a little bit for people. And so it worries me. I will say this. The moment I walked in the door to Harriet's house in Charleston, I asked for two things: who killed Asmodean and the ending. Because everyone knew Jim had the ending in mind, and she had told me ahead of time, yes, he did write the ending before he passed away. And so I walked in the door before even she asked me if I wanted food, and I said, no, get me those, please. And so I sat down and read those, and I loved the ending. The ending was fantastic. Having been a reader, and you know, I'm now kind of the public face of the Wheel of Time, and so some people kind of roll their eyes when I say things like this, but it's really true. As a fan of the series for almost 20 years, reading that ending was everything I'd been waiting for. It was that sort of, that surprising yet inevitable sort of thing that we always try in writing. We want it to just feel right, and it's so hard to explain how an ending feels right. This one felt right to me. And so I've got that to work toward. And so there were surprises. There were things I wasn't expecting. A little bit of surprise for each of the characters, to be honest. And yet at the same time, that's what you want. You want surprising yet not shocking, if that makes sense. I mean, we want to be shocking sometimes, but we don't want an ending like this to just, yeah, you know what I mean? You want it to fulfill the promises that the series has been making for so many years. And it fulfilled those promises for me. I would say the most surprising I can't even say without spoiling who's going to be. I'd say that Egwene's viewpoint had a few of the biggest surprises, but that's not necessarily saying. There's another viewpoint that had big surprises, but I can't mention it because then it gives away things about the story. And so, interview me, you know, next year after it's out, and I'll tell you. But there was one where I read, I was at this point reading through all the notes. I'd read the ending as going back to the notes, and I said, what? And then I'm like, oh, I guess that does make sense. But there was an exclaimed out loud what of confusion for a moment at one point in the notes. So just remember that and ask me, and I'll tell you once the book's out, okay?
All right, not a problem. I will definitely try to take you up on that particular offer.
Oh, I'll definitely be back if you want me to, actually, after the book comes out. I can say so much more after the book's out. Anyway.
We'd love to hear it, I know.
Absolutely. As kind of a follow-up to that question, you mentioned that when you first walked into Harriet's house, you wanted to ask her two things. So my question is, are there other questions that come up for you as you're in the process of writing Memory of Light? And what do you do when those questions come up?
Yes. By questions, you mean things Jim didn't answer?
Yes,
or
things that you as a fan had
wondered about
and
it, yeah.
That section and you're writing about
right.
The characters.
There are
still come up for you.
There are a lot of those, to be honest. Jim hit the most important things first, and which means that some of the littler things, but which aren't little to us fans who've been reading for years, get left a little bit in the air. Now, fortunately, he's got a character file where for a lot of them, he'll have one or two lines on what their end, how they end up, which gives us a lot of clues for what he was planning. But some of these smaller characters, he didn't have that, and we don't know. So my first, when I have a question like that, the first thing I do is I email the Holy Triumvirate back in Charleston, which is Harriet, Alan, and Maria, and I say, do we know? Did he mention it to you? And a lot of the times, Maria will dig out he mentioned that, he said this. Or Alan will pull out of the notes file in a place I didn't notice, look, there's a line here that gives us an answer. Sometimes there is no answer. And at that point, this is why they bring in a fantasy writer, a guy who loves the series but also has written a lot himself, rather than having someone else do it. People have asked, well, why not have Harriet write it? Well, Harriet's a brilliant editor. She's one of the best editors in the business, to be honest. She edited Ender's Game and Eye of the World. I mean, the two, in my opinion, biggest science fiction fantasy books of the century. And so, but she is not a writer. She said that. I'm not a writer. My job is to take what a writer does and make it excellent. And so the reason I was brought on is because I've got those writer senses. And like I said, like finishing the Da Vinci painting, another painter can say, okay, I think it was going to go here. I can measure this, and it's just an instinctive thing. And sometimes I just have to rely on my desires as a fan and say, okay, this is what I wanted to have happen all these years, so we're going to make it happen. And in some cases, there are actually a number of places in the notes where Jim says, this does not get answered. And I can, in a year, I can tell you what those are. And so every time he says that, that does not get answered. I mean, if it's in the notes anywhere specifically, we do what Jim said. There's no question whether, you know, to change anything or to alter anything. The only things that I'm changing or altering of Jim's work are where it's obviously a rough draft and he intended to clean up the language. And I'll do that, but Harriet will watch very carefully on those. And then if he wrote two contradictory things, which he does not fairly often, but occasionally, as he's saying, and it'll almost always have a maybe. Maybe this or maybe this. I have to decide between those two which thing to do. Maybe they'll do this, maybe they'll do this. And so in those cases, I'm making the decisions. But otherwise, if it's in the notes anywhere, we just do it. But when there are holes, that's when me as the fan gets to have the most wonderful opportunity ever, which is I get to decide how this goes. And I will add I think you may be asking me about this, but I'll just say it now. I hope to be able to persuade the powers that be to do maybe not a whole publication of just the notes, but a book where we publish some of the notes and then talk about what I adapted and why I decided what I did, and publish chunks of the notes and even the transcripts of the audio or things like that. It would be awesome if we could release a little CD with it that has some of those dictations. The thing about that is you have to remember that Jim really didn't like people to read his unpolished writing. In fact, he would go through 12 drafts often before he would show it to Harriet.
Wow.
So he was I think it made him very uncomfortable, and so that's the worry in publishing the notes. I think we can do it respectfully in a way where we say, here's a section of notes, and these other sections were like this, so we're not just publishing all of his dirty laundry, you know, so to speak, for people to see, but we publish a little paragraph and say, there were a lot of sections that were like this. Here's the paragraph, here's the finished paragraph, and here's an explanation of other sections that were like this. that's what I'm hoping to do. We'll see if they go with it, if they go for it. But in all of these things, Harriet has the last decision, and rightly so. She gets to decide. If she makes a decision, she doesn't think that Jim would have wanted that to get published, then by golly, you know, I mean, Harriet knows Jim better than anyone. We listen to Harriet, and we do what Harriet says. And so we'll just have to see.
I almost think that would be like publishing, you know, Da Vinci's sketches or notes. I don't think it would be disrespectful.
Right,
it would
right.
be a clue into how a master
right.
works.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's how I feel, too. But at the same time, we want to be respectful
sure.
to Jim's memory. But we know that, you know, Jim, I posted the essay on this in July. We know that Jim changed his mind about a lot of things as the end grew near. He didn't reformat his hard drive, as he always threatened to do before he passed away so the book couldn't be written. He instead asked for Harriet to find someone to write it. And so he may, even if he was uncomfortable about this, this may be something that he would have been persuaded to do. So we'll just wait and see what Harriet says.
You ever feel like, we call him RJ, we didn't know him as Jim, but
yeah.
do you ever feel like he's sort of looking over your shoulder as you write?
Oh, yeah.
Is that creepy sometimes?
Boy, you know, if I ever sit and think about it directly, it does a little bit, and I hope he's not sitting there saying, no, you fool, what, no! I hope he's not doing that. I hope he's saying, oh, good, someone's finishing it, and it's going to turn out good. That's what I'm hoping. I mean, I believe in an afterlife, and so I do believe that, you know, he's up there watching, and so I'm going to have to face him and say, here's what I did, and hope that he's happy and not angry. And that does affect me.
I'm sure it would. Yeah, I'm hoping he's looking down and going,
yeah.
well done, my son.
Yeah, yeah. So,
you know, that has to be hard. It's got to be a real experience.
Yeah, you know, not disappointing him and Harriet is a much bigger weight for me than not disappointing the fans. And not disappointing the fans is a huge weight
yeah.
in its own. And so that's one of the big differences in working on this book as opposed to other books that I've written. When I write my own books, I do think of my readers, but I tell the story I want to tell. And then after the fact, I think, wow, how are they going to respond to this? In this case, there's more of a, what would Jim want? What will Harriet want? What are the fans wanting? And that affects me much more. It doesn't make me, I don't know if it changes my writing specifically, but it does make me pause and think about what I'll include. If there's time that I can include something extra that I know that we've all been waiting for, I try to get it in there. And I know what people are waiting for. I don't know if I can promise a Narg cameo. I mean, that may be a little extreme. Did he die?
He died.
The Dark One can bring people back. So, I mean, it's
standing joke among us.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he could bring Narg back. No, I don't know if we'll have that sort of thing is, of course. But, you know, I want to be able to work in things like Bella, or is it Bela? Is it Bella?
I don't know.
I say Bella. I want to be able to work in things like this that I've loved for years. And so just remember, I'm one of you, and I want answers to these things. And if there isn't an answer in the book, then it's probably one of two things. Either we decided that putting it in impeded the flow of the story too much, or Jim said, don't include this. And I will try to, in that book of notes, if I ever manage to do that, put a list of, Jim said, don't do this, just so you know, so you don't come burn down my house for not including an answer that we all wanted. Jim often said he wants the Wheel of Time to keep on turning long after, you know, he's no longer working on it. And the best way to do that is to leave little clues so that we can have podcasts where we discuss them, where we can talk about it. I don't think the best way to do that is to endlessly publish Wheel of Time books. I think our imaginations are better, and I think the story stands stronger leaving it as Jim left it. And so, yeah, I think that we will leave those little holes open. If there are holes open, that's not a promise that we're going to write those books. It's a think about it yourself. Come up with the stories yourself.
I'd rather hope that there might be some possibility that the other novels that he discussed
yeah.
in the series might be published. I think I read someplace that there wasn't any plan to do any more, like the Outrigger novels that he was talking about, or a couple of the sequels with,
yeah.
you know, Tulan, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right,
yeah.
Tulan and
I think those actually were the Outrigger novels. I'm not 100% sure on that. Like, you talk about them separately. I think Tom Doherty assumes those two were the same, Outriggers and the Madden 2-1 books.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance for the prequels. It's up to Harriet. I really want to see Tam's story be told.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I've wanted since the beginning, since book one. There are so many hints to a greater story behind Tam. And so that's the story I most would want to tell. But balancing that on the other side is the knowledge that, like I said, I do not want Wheel of Time to go on, the series to go on forever. Of course, the wheel keeps turning, but this is not an opportunity to just publish the heck out of something. This is not an opportunity to just say, hey, let's make a lot of bucks publishing. This series is part of my soul. It's what I grew up reading. I don't want it exploited, even by me, so to speak. And that's a big, big weight in my mind. The knowledge that Jim said, I don't want people finishing even the last book. If he said that a couple of times, even though he changed his mind on that, knowing that makes me think he certainly wouldn't want us writing books he didn't plan. And so at the most, you would see the two prequels and two or three Outrigger novels. He did say some things about them. That would be the most that I would think we would see. At the least, we will see none of that. It'll be up to Harriet. My guess right now is, it's hard to say because we're also focused on book 12. My guess off the cuff would be you'll see the prequels in a couple of years, maybe 5 years or so. I mean, we would wait and then do those two, and I don't know if we will see the Outriggers at all. I certainly am not thinking that it would be a good idea to do the Infinity of Heaven. Is that what it was called? I really don't think that would be a good idea. That would be like all the people who were trying to do Gene Roddenberry films based off, or TV shows based off of, like, three scribbled notes he left behind or things like this. I really just don't think that would be appropriate. And I certainly don't think it would be appropriate to the further adventures of the Wheel of Time. So, yeah, that's my guess. It'll be up to Harriet, though. It really is all up to Harriet. And, anything could happen. She could decide, look, we've got enough notes, let's do this. She could decide, let's do a prequel. She could, about Arthur Hawkwing or something like that. I mean, Archer Hawkwing, I guess. Yeah, any of these things are possible, but I think they're very unlikely. I will add to say, whatever Harriet asks me to do, I will do, because I don't want anyone else doing it, to be perfectly honest. But my counsel to her will, and we're on the same page in this, she doesn't, but will be, let's be very hesitant and careful. So.
I think most of the fans are probably on the same page
yeah.
as both of you. Nobody wants to see it exploited, but
yeah.
on the other hand, if I may irritate the heck out of Mark and do a little crossover, it drove me crazy, the end of the Harry Potter
series. Yeah.
Because, I had to read it in an article that somebody published in a newsletter
uh-huh.
somewhere she gave an interview about what happened to all the kids.
Yeah.
And that drove me nuts. I think if I happened to see that, I would never know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well,
it would be nice.
Likewise, 20 years. Okay.
Yeah. It would be nice to, in the notes, be able to say, publish some of those things. This is what happens. Some of those character things, this is how they end up. I'm hoping most of those will end up in the book. And the thing about this is, Jim could have said more. I'm not going to make up futures for the characters beyond the books, so I won't make things up and say, well, this is what happens to this person. I'm not going to do that. If it's not in Jim's notes and it doesn't end up in book 12, or perhaps Outrigger novels, I don't have ownership over these characters. I'm stepping in to help, a dear mentor who can't finish the project on his own, but they're still all his. So, anyway, I'm rambling now.
No, I'm even more excited now because I think you're going to be a wonderful custodian of the characters, and you're really...
I hope to be.
Making it what you want.
We've been waiting so long,
yeah.
And I really, really wish he were here to do it. I honestly really wish that he were here doing this instead of me. But if he can't be here to do it, I want to be the one doing it because I at least know that someone who's read the series for so long and who loves it will be taking care of it. So,
Mark, do you have any more questions? I'm kind of ignoring you. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
And everything, I apologize.
This sort of goes back against something that you said earlier that you don't really want to get into, but so you don't really have to ask it if you don't really want to, but which character or characters do you or can you most identify with on a personal level?
I did a list, some responses on my website as I was rereading through the series again. And I think I found that at certain points in the story, I identified with everyone. I think this was one of Jim's greatest skills as a writer, was to make a wide variety of different characters identifiable. When I first read through the series when I was a teenage boy, I identified with Matt and Perrin and Rand almost exclusively. This latest time, reading through the series, I found myself identifying with the characters who were a little bit more mature, a little bit older, specifically Maureen and Nynaeve, and even Morgaze. Morgaze, is that how you say it? I'll add the caveat also here. When I first read through the books all those years ago, I didn't pay any attention to pronunciation. I really never did. They were that word on the page, and that became their name in my head. But I never said it out loud. I can remember the first time I heard someone pronounce Nynaeve's name. It was like 3 or 4 years after I'd read the first book. And I'm like, that's how you say it? Oh! And so having this project now of working on it, I think I need to learn how to say things appropriately. The problem is a lot of people even disagree. People who claim to have talked to Robert Jordan and heard him say it will argue with each other over the pronunciation. Like even Nynaeve, I was at DragonCon. Someone's like, no, he pronounced it Nineveh. And I'm like, they said, I heard it in an interview. And someone else said, no, I heard him say Nynaeve. When I was at in Charleston, I asked about pronouncing Morgaze's name, and several of the people among the Holy Triumvirate there all had different pronunciations.
No.
It all worked with Jim.
Oh, my God.
Different pronunciations. I'm like, how can I get this right? And you guys don't even know. So anyway, I can remember reading through for the first time, not really being interested in Morgaze's story. And this time, now being a father and being older and things, I identify very much with her viewpoints. And Swan's viewpoints the same way. And so it's different. It's hard to say. Who do I identify most with? I don't know. And I hesitate to answer also because the people I sometimes have the most trouble understanding are also the most exciting to write, because they're so odd sometimes, if that makes sense. Like, you know, Tuon, the way she thinks is fascinating. I don't identify with her because I don't think that way, but that doesn't mean I'm not excited and enjoying writing her, because she is so odd. It's one of the wonderful things about Jim's writing is you can tell where someone is from by reading their narrative. And so, anyway, there's a rambling sort of answer to the side of your question that hopefully won't make anyone send me hate mail.
If they do, they got to send it to the rest of us as well, because we brought up.
I'm just glad to hear that everybody has problems with the pronunciations, because
yeah.
I struggle with it endlessly, and I thought my first thing was, well, you can just go ask the Holy Triumvirate.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
they don't even know, they don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no hope for any of us.
They know on most things, but it was just funny to me that they all were kind of, and I think Maria won, but she usually does, when it came to the right pronunciation, but yeah, so.
What we should do is get them on a podcast and just have them pronounce all these names, because we get grief on the podcast,
yeah.
Because we don't do it the same as
right.
Same as,
yeah.
We're in the same boat as you. We've read it through 9 times.
Yeah.
We've never spoken it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or we pick it up from the audiobooks,
yeah.
When you listen to those.
Yeah, but apparently the audiobooks get some things wrong, so yeah. In fact, it seems like I think they're called there are places where the two readers pronounce things differently from one another.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, the only answer would be to have Jim come down in, you know, a column of light and say, it is thus. But I suppose if we can pick it out of any interviews he did, we would know. But
I suppose. I had a little tiny clip of an interview that
mm-hmm.
did in Pasadena. I think it was the last book tour. And strangely enough, before we had even met, Jesse and I were at that same
okay.
signing.
Yeah.
And I had never listened to the little clip that was on my cell phone. And I found it and I went, I have a little clip of Robert Jordan
mm-hmm.
pronouncing what I always thought in my mind were Shido, and he said, it's not Shido, it's not Shido, it's Shido. I'm going, oh!
Wow.
Okay.
Shido, huh?
Shido. Okay.
Okay. Well,
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. Okay.
And I said, at that particular particular signing, there were words that he pronounced that I had no idea what he was talking about. Like, I don't remember exactly which one it was, but there were names that he said that I just had absolutely no clue who he was talking about.
Well,
but I think it's very interesting that when I first started doing the podcast, one of my biggest fears was pronunciations, because obviously everybody has their own. But what I've also noticed is very interesting is that I can spell just about any word in the Wheel of Time when I'm emailing the other podcast members.
Mm-hmm. Because, well, he was good at, it is actually very phonetic.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of his names and things like this is more phonetic than English. And I think that he was, that might have been why he was so specific about pronunciations. I know that he liked people to pronounce the things the right way. And he would correct people and things like this, which is actually different for me because in my book, I often pronounce the characters' names wrong. This is, I guess, a little aside, but I have in my head how they in the world would pronounce the name, and sometimes that sounds awkward to me, so I don't do it that way. Because I'm not from that country, I don't speak their language, and so I pronounce it like an American would. So you'll hear me pronounce my character's name three or four different ways, but Jim was, I think, very particular on this. And so I think that's why we all try to do it the right way, if there is one, because we knew that Jim liked his characters to pronounce that the right way. Yeah, so.
Well, if I can ask a misborn question then, tell me how I pronounce Kel's name.
I say Kelsier. They would indeed say Kelsier. They would say Kelsier in the world, but I say Kelsier.
Okay.
So there you go.
Okay.
I'm
good with that. I just hate getting stuff wrong, too, and my worst fear would have been to speak to an author and, like, butcher the names that they've, you know, got in their mind.
It's the pleasure of creating.
Yeah.
One of my questions is that the role of women in the world of Wheel of Time has attracted a lot of female fans and a lot of female fans that would not normally be into fantasy
books, right.
Myself included.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Jordan mentioned at, you know, various things and obviously had very strong female character influences in his life. And I'm wondering if you have any very strong female character influences in your life.
Indeed I do. I think that might have been what attracted me to the Wheel of Time. My mother is an extremely strong individual. She graduated first of her class in accounting in a time where she was the only woman in the entire accounting department, and has always been, very, very, just very much like an Aes Sedai, honestly. My mother reminds me, or they remind me of my mother, I guess. And beyond that, I got into reading fantasy because of two authors. This was before Wheel of Time was published. I got into fantasy because of Annie McCaffrey and Barbara Hambly. Dragon's Bane was the book that brought me into fantasy. And these are books written by women with strong female characters that drove it. In fact, for the longest time, until actually I started really reading Robert Jordan, I thought that guys couldn't write fantasy as well as women could, because my experience was with that and with Melanie Ron. Those three were the characters of the writers I loved to read the most. And so I think that influences my writing. There's a reason why the Mistborn trilogy has a girl as a hero. Number one, because I haven't seen as many women in the role that she's playing, and partially also because it's just natural to me. And I have never yet written a book where I strive for balance. But I think I may overcompensate being a guy to try and give the female perspective to try and balance things out. I often do that in my writing. If I feel that there's something that a person I am like, I try to overbalance the other side. If there's a viewpoint I hold, I try to make the other side even stronger, because I know my inherent bias is going to go one direction, if that makes any sense. So me being a guy who's very religious, if I have an atheist in my books, I try to make sure I'm having their viewpoint be even stronger and more legitimate, just because I know my normal bias will be toward the religious characters, if that makes any sense. So I hope it comes out with each character being strong in their own right and no one being undermined by the way the story happens or the narrative goes. Even the villains, I don't want the story to inherently undermine them because they're the heroes in their minds. And so that's what I try to do. I don't know. It's hard to try to sit back and analyze my own writing, but I do know that I don't enjoy reading fantasy books unless there are strong protagonists in both genders. I enjoy them much more when I've got both.
Yeah.
so.
That's interesting. I had to laugh when you said that about your mother. One of the things that happened to me in high school was I signed up totally oblivious for electronics. And because I was into a Star Trek, you know. Really into the sciences. Oh, this will be fun. Next thing I know, the school paper's interviewing me. How do you feel being the first woman ever to have signed up for electronics? I never thought about it. I did.
What
do you feel? You know, like some prodigy,
which
just
worked. And it's interesting to me, like, that era, like, my mother was a very big deal. I don't even think about these things, honestly. It's even strange for me to consider that there would be only one woman in the accounting department and that it would be a big deal. Because in my mind, an accountant is a woman because my mom is always, you know, it's kind of strange, but I guess the world was a different place 30 years ago, and,
I don't know if it's better or worse now, but it certainly changed.
Yeah.
The nature of reality. When you're writing your own characters, do you tend to have one particular character that you identify with, or are you just sort of trying to...
I put my heart into every character. They're different bits of me in every character, but I really have trouble picking a favorite. Often in my annotations I'll say, this is probably my favorite character, but that's who my favorite character is at that moment, looking back. When I'm writing a character, they become my favorite character when I set pen to paper for that character. That's the way it has to be. You have to be, you know, when you're seeing through their viewpoint, they are the most important person in the world. That's how because we can't see through other people's eyes. We are... You know, we have our own experience, and every character you write has to be that way. They have to see that, you know, you can't be writing a character and knowing that this other character is better or more interesting, because then the character you're writing will fall flat. And so whoever you're writing, it has to be. That's why I tried to add that caveat earlier on, that when I mention Wheel of Time, a favorite character or a favorite scene or a favorite part, that all goes out the window the moment I sit down to write a given viewpoint. At that time, that character is the most important, and that story is the most important. Even if it's a tiny side character with just kind of that's only had two or three viewpoints in the series, they become the most important for that moment.
I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the Wheel of Time. It's so difficult to pick a favorite character because you love so many of them. But I know a lot of people have spent energy trying to decide which character Robert Jordan put himself into most.
Yeah.
Some people say Loyal, and some people say others and like that. And do you think there was one that he actually did? And is there one that you kind of see yourself in most? I mean...
Yeah, it's a hard... It is really hard. Because being, you know, a guy who went through those hard years of teenage years and things, Rand's story is the hero's journey, which is a little bit of all of us go through this, and so there's that. But through a lot of my life, I was the quiet guy like Perrin, which is why particularly when I was younger and I was reading, Perrin was the one I identified with most, because I felt like him. But, you know, who doesn't want to be like Matt on occasion?
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean...
Even girls.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I've said book 11, Egwene was my favorite. I really... connected with Egwene being in that sort of underdog situation, which is in the White Tower, and she's not bending despite the fact that they all are trying to get her to bend. I think there were only like two or three chapters, but that was wonderful. It's like the most memorable parts of that book were hers. And so
she really came into her own.
Yeah, she really came into her own. Yep. Knife of Dreams with Egwene. Yeah, and Crossroads as well. But man, just really started to shine, which is almost intimidating, because there were other characters who were poised to do that as well. And you could see that he was pushing them toward that for book 12, and now I've got to make them, you know. And then I've got to continue Egwene, because I think Egwene has come to her own. It's, you know, it's time for Egwene to really, you know, there's no more... no more wavering for Egwene, no more hedging, no more worrying or one. I mean, there'll still, of course, be in little things in the back of her head, but she is in charge now, even if she doesn't look like she is. And it's time for her to be the Amaryllis. Oh, how do you say that?
I think it's Amaryllis.
Amaryllis. Okay, good. I said it right. You know, it's time for that. And that's really exciting, but it's also intimidating.
She's still got a lot of her work cut out for her.
Yeah, she really does. But that's exciting. That's wonderful. I mean, you can see it in book 11, what's going to happen in book 12 with her. For her viewpoint specifically, Jim left a lot of notes and a lot of actual writing segments and things. And so that was fun to read.
Well, there was a lot of foreshadowing for her in the earlier books becoming the Armorland.
Yeah.
People would mention it.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll be Armorland when I'll be queen of, you know, But honestly, for a long time, I really didn't think that would ever come true. She seemed almost like a minor character for the longest time. So I was kind of glad to see her.
Yeah, different characters go through phases in the books where they almost feel like minor characters. And when I introduce the books to people, when I give them Eye of the World, I always am sure I say, remember that this is the story of the world first. And the characters are, you know, it's the story of all of the characters, if that makes sense. There is really, in my mind, no one main character of the Wheel of Time. And other people say, oh, there's five main characters. No, it's the story of the end of an era and told through the viewpoints of the characters living it. And it's a story. It's all of their story.
Yeah.
Now, he's chosen some of the most important ones to focus on, but it really is all of their story.
One thing that we saw in Knife of Dreams that I know as it progresses and the series progresses, was that there were some point of views from characters that had not had point of view before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, can we look forward to any new characters that we haven't seen a point of view from before? Memory of Light.
Yes.
Okay.
There are some that Jim wrote himself, and I know of one specifically that I'm hoping to add. It's not a new character, but it's a viewpoint I would like to see through the eyes for just occasionally. It's not going to be very, very much, but for at least three or four chapters, there's one that I'm hoping to do.
Okay.
So the answer to that is yes, but I can't give you any specifics.
Okay.
Actually, I have sort of a personal request.
Okay.
There are a lot of phrases in the old tongue in the book, and as a podcaster, we've all tried to come up with some sort of a signature phrase. To say, Andrew has his famous one now. But it dawned on me not too long ago that there is no way to say that I've ever seen to say light.
Okay.
Could you please write that in there so that some of us can say the light illumine you or walk in the light or something?
I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Old tongue, I honestly send to the triumvirate and say, you know, okay, guys, I need this translated.
Yeah.
You go for it. I'm not doing old tongue myself. I'm letting them do it. And I'm actually letting them do most naming, too, because if I start naming people too much, I'll fall back on my naming convention.
Sure.
They're so distinctive that I'll write in a placeholder and then I'll say, Maria, give me a proper IEL name for this, or, you know, something like that. Give me a Sean Chan name. Put it in here, and you guys, and they'll go look through Jim's notes for unused names, and probably pick one of those if I need to name somebody, and stuff like that. And I know Alan has written out some stuff in the old tongue before. He knows it pretty well. So I let them handle all that. I'll try my best.
Thank you. It just seems like a big omission to me that there are ways to say almost everything except that. And it's just a crucial part of the, you know, the philosophy and everything in the Wheel of Time. So I thought, well, I'd just like to be able to say that.
It wouldn't surprise me if something simple for that would be just like Aviero Light or something like that. Like the direct translation from the old tongue to the new tongue would just be the same word. It wouldn't surprise me.
Did you have a question mark?
Actually, this is something I think Virginia thought up, but I'm with her 150% on this idea. And you sort of half covered it earlier again with your talk about releasing notes or not releasing notes. But what we've got as the so-called Big White Book, which is the World of the Time, that covers up to book 7. Is there any plans or thoughts or hopes, aside from our own, to release a sort of version 2 that'll cover up books 8 through 12?
I know that there were certain people who were displeased with the Big White Book in some ways. And I do know, I think Harriet is working on a comprehensive encyclopedia.
Ooh.
I don't know what the state of that is. I don't know if it's been actually greenlit or anything like that. But I do know that there is work on her part that she and Alan and Maria are going to compile and release, or hopefully. So I'll just give you that and say I think that's in the works.
So I think that they're already ahead of us on that one. And we can look forward to that. So I think she's hoping to have it done the year after A Memory of Light, and then maybe go with the paperback release of A Memory of Light. That would be...
That'd be awesome.
So, I do know she's working on it. But it's been a rough time for Harriet last year. And, when Jim passed away, she almost, it seems like, considered it a dying request. I don't know. I haven't asked her how she regarded it, but to find somebody seemed like she... A lot of people told me she looked like she had a weight on her shoulders until she knew that A Memory of Light was being taken care of. And so she jumped on that. And she had someone, I was chosen in November. And so that was only, 2 months later? Mm-hmm. And so she was really focused on that. But once that happened, I think it was time to just, now I've got a deal. And after someone that close to you passes away, they say don't make any big decisions for a year.
Yeah.
And be very careful about things. And so I think she's taking her time, but I think it is something of a focus for her, something to keep working. And so I bet we'll see it, the year or two after, there should be a big, nice encyclopedia released.
Yeah, I think there would be a lot of people who would be very excited about that.
Yeah, I think that'll happen, and I honestly think that the notes book will happen if I ask, if I request the ability to do it. She made, it's up to her, but I think it'll happen. So I think you'll see both of these things to kind of keep us sated for a little while longer.
Well, everybody in the Wheel of Time fandom, if you will, is going to jump on anything like that.
Yeah.
We love all that.
Well, and what I really want to see them do is, and this is speaking as a fan, would be a nice 12-volume leather-bound set.
Oh, yeah.
I really want to see that. I think that would be awesome, particularly if, and I think you have a question about this that I saw, particularly if they end up splitting A Memory of Light into two volumes, mm-hmm. having it then bound into one, a leather bound would be way cool. Though, part of me says, but then it would be 12 books instead of 13. If they do split it, there's 13, and that's, but anyway, yeah. Perhaps I had a talk on that. Do you have a question about that? Why don't you read that one to me somewhere?
I just have that one, actually.
Yeah. Since I already brought it up, let's.
I know the books are long enough, but I'd sort of love to see a really full set of appendices, I think, like The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah. And I think that'll be the encyclopedia.
Yeah. I know in your blog you discuss your concerns and address the questions about the length of the book, A Memory of Light, and I was really glad to hear that you were willing to go to bat with us with Tor to make it be the length that it needs to be, to be the book that it needs to be. And there's a possibility that it might be cut into two segments, and if so, you wanted them to be released together or close to it and not years apart. So I think that's really great. And, as I said, you can make it a million words for all I care. I buy everything that you write. So
I'm shooting, my progress bar on my website goes up to 400,000. That's not going to be the end of the book. I can tell you right now that it's not going to be anywhere near the end of the book.
Wow.
600,000 is probably I'm thinking the minimum. And so expect a 600,000 word book. It may be even a little tad longer than that.
How does that compare to the longest of the previous 11?
That's right. Writers, just as a caveat, writers think of things in word count rather than page count, because pages can be changed and things like this.
Paperback or
Paperback, hardback, and you can change the leading on pages and put more lines on or shrink the font and things like that. So we learned to think in word count. Books 4 and 6 were both right around 390,000, and they're the longest in the series.
Wow.
Shortest in the series is, I forget. Was it Crown of Swords?
I think so.
Dragon Reborn, it might be. We'd have to look, but I think that the shortest is, in the 220 to 240 range, which is the longest of my books, by the way. My longest book is Mistborn, Well of Ascension, Book 2, at 240, I think. So the shortest Wheel of Time books are as long as the longest, but that's because bookstores have been begging the publishers to release the book, make the book shorter. Because of shelf space and because of costs and all of these things, they've just been begging and begging and begging. And so I've had to fight to get my books to I write at about 200,000 naturally. Mm-hmm. That's just what my books turn out to be. So I'm not artificially lengthening them or shortening them, but I had to fight to get 240 accepted. Tor's been pushing a lot of its authors to shoot for the 120 range.
Wow.
That's been, you know, in most genres, 120 is a long novel. It, just understand that. And in thrillers, you know, 90,000 or 100,000 is what they're looking for. In science fiction, that's what they're looking for. Mysteries go shorter than that. Most genres, 120 is a big, big book. So 390 is just enormous. And 600?
beyond the beyond.
And at one of my signings, someone last night or the night before pointed out and said, you know, Jim said he was going to force Tor to publish it as one book no matter what, even if they had to invent a new binding system and give people a wheelbarrow or whatever it is.
Luggage cart.
Yeah, luggage cart to get it out. And, you know, maybe Jim would have been able to pull that off. It would have meant Tor having to publish the book and lose a lot of money. Yeah. Well, they wouldn't have lost money, you know. It
but,
probably
yeah,
would have had
terrible.
To charge like $60 for the book, and they would have had to have tiny, tiny, tiny font. Jim could have forced them to do that. I honestly don't think Jim would have. We've seen Jim backpedal on things like that before, specifically on the length of the series. He said
it's going to be a trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've seen Jim do that. And so I think that if it went to 600 or 700,000 words, Tom Doherty and probably Harriet, too, would have sat down with him and said, look, people will be buying the book and the binding will be breaking and the book immediately, the covers will be falling off and things like this. Can we please split into two? He probably, I'm like 95% sure he would have said yes if it went that long. Now, the thing is, Jim was hoping to write the book and get it done before he passed away. And I think he was in his mind shrinking it a little bit with the hopes of getting it done. And, you know, I personally would have rather read a shortened version and had him write it. But now that we don't have to worry about time and length, I'm going to do it the length I think it needs to be, and the notes indicate it needs to be. And beyond that, even it's the length that reading up to book 11 indicates. You've all read book 11. You've probably read it several times.
Yeah.
You know where everyone ends, and it's nowhere near where everyone needs to be.
No.
And so
many plot lines.
Yeah, so many plot lines. And if I were to come in and say I'm going to do this in 400,000 words, that would mean I'm having to artificially either ignore plot lines or just tie them up with a little neat bow, which is not right. We need time for each of these characters. I mean, we need people like Morges, who were very important for a number of books. We can't just give them one chapter and then be done with them and never see them again. We've got to have time to – it just has – It's not going to be right unless we do. And so that's why I'm writing it the way I am. And, you know, I don't really care who complains. This is how long it needs to be. And the way I'm approaching it is I've picked a point where there was a big sort of climactic thing, essentially kind of the kickoff into the last battle. I picked that point in the book, and I said I'm going to write each viewpoint up to that point. And I'm shooting for 400,000 on that. If that makes sense. Because it's a natural, after writing the for a while on it, I said, they're going to cut this in two. I just know they are.
Yeah.
And so I picked a good climactic moment in the outline, and I'm writing to that. It was actually a little bit further than half. And I thought this will make a very good, dramatic place if we do have to cut the book, so it won't feel like stop in the middle and then part two, in case they decide to make them. Because, you know, I've said, hey, would you guys publish this as volume one and volume two? I don't know if they'll do that. They may say book 12, book 13. Who knows what they will do? They're in charge of packaging it and everything like that. I'm just in charge of writing. So anyway, I'm writing each viewpoint up to that point.
Okay.
And I'm writing them by groups, by clusters. It's almost like I'm writing five books,
wow,
to be honest. That's how I'm approaching it, is I said, okay, who's together? Or kind of sometimes in story together, even though they're separated by distance, but whose stories belong being told together? And I lumped them in groups, and it came out to natural groups of five. We've got Rand, and, you know, Nynaeve and Cad Swain and everybody who's there with Rand, and that you know, Alvienda is in there because they're kind of all heading the same direction. And then there's Perrin, and we've got Perrin's group. And, you know, Morghese is there, and Fael, and Galad is only like a couple day march away.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing, you know, and I've got that. That's a book. And then there's Matt, And Matt really only, you know, he at least has fewer people hanging out with him to keep track of, but there's still quite a bit going on there.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a book
people.
There. And then there's the Egwene / you know, the Rebel Aes Sedai / you know, Gowen is in that group, kind of. Is that how you say that, Gowen?
That's how I would
yeah. say it. He's in that group. And then there's the other. That would include, you know, Elaine is kind of also come to her own, and there's stuff going on with her. But we've got her. We've got the Black Tower with Pavara and people who are there. And, you know, I don't even know. Yeah, we've got Loghain. We've got Thane running around. And then we've got, you know, the little characters like, Bale Doman.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say that right?
Yeah.
I've never actually said that name out loud, so there we go.
We
and,
did a podcast
okay.
on Bale and Light.
The Sean Chan. Egyanen? Okay.
I'm not sure how you pronounce that either.
I say Egyanen, but...
Okay, Egyanen. Those two, you know, we don't want to leave, you know? Anyway, there's all of these people. I think the most controversial part of that is that people may be annoyed that Elaine isn't her own book. But Elaine, you got to remember, the way the Wheel of Time works is certain characters get focused on for a while,
mm-hmm.
and there will certainly be Elaine parts in the book, but Elaine is the only one poised to be where she needs to be.
Right. She doesn't have to go anywhere.
She doesn't have to go anywhere. She's poised to launch into things. She's now queen. Everything's not easy. I mean, there's still stuff for her to do, but she's, I think, of all the characters at the end of Knife of Dreams, and looking at the notes as well as what he was planning, is she's the one poised to just launch into the last battle. Everyone else has to catch up, and so that means that that I'm kind of lumping her in that group of let's make sure I deal with her, but she's kind of waiting for everybody to catch up, and so that's how I'm approaching it. When I start writing her viewpoints, she may turn into her own book, and it may grow longer even than I'm expecting. But so that's how I'm approaching the book. And then, of course, there's the prologue, which Jim wrote a lot of himself. And anytime I'm getting chunks that Jim wrote, I just insert them and then keep going is how I'm working on it. And then blending, hopefully, so that it doesn't look like it. So far, it doesn't feel jarring to me when I do that. But we'll let Harriet kind of smooth and help with the editing on that. And then I'll get to that point, and then I'll say, okay, now we've got 400 or 500,000 words. Now what? And then I'll go into the next quote-unquote book, the second half, or the second book if it's cut that way.
I think you would need a prologue for the second one if you split it?
I don't know. It'll depend on if they do it as part two. I don't know that I will add a prologue.
Yeah.
Even if they do it as book 13, there are books without prologues that Jim didn't write them.
Yeah.
And so the prologues are such a part of what Jim did. I don't know. I would have to decide whether to add one or not. We'll look at it then.
Do you think they'll release the prologue ahead of time the way they have in the past?
I think that they probably will. I haven't really asked, but they've done it in the past.
Yeah.
And but, you know, the prologue has so much of – it's got so much Jim in it that I think it would be good for people to – does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's one of the last parts – of Jim that's kind of complete that we have, if that makes sense, because his prologues almost have their own, they're almost like little novellas themselves. And so it would be nice to release, because the only other really complete section is the ending. In between there, what I've got are paragraphs or
mm-hmm.
parts of scenes or, you know, writing here or dictations or this. And so, yeah.
It'd almost be like a little closure to have that, you know,
yeah.
that piece of what he did all
mm-hmm.
together like that. This might be a little bit too content-oriented, so
yeah.
don't answer it if you don't want to. But as you were speaking just now, it suddenly occurred to me, can you tell us if the last battle is going to be like a worldwide event, or is it going to be located in like certain central areas that all the characters are going to have to converge
to? Let's see.
I don't know if
I
can answer that.
Can I answer that? That is detailed in the notes. I really should stay away from answering that.
Okay. Forget I asked.
But let's just say it will cover hundreds of thousands of words. So.
That is amazing to me, too, because I guess I tend to think of I've become so used to reading The Wheel of Time and other authors, and like Colleen McCullough, you know,
uh-huh.
Masters of Rome series, they're all, you know,
yeah.
like Wheel of Time size.
Yeah.
And so to me, that seems normal now.
Yeah.
And when I go back and read Barbara Hambly's books,
yeah.
and I adore her work,
yeah.
but now it's like, what is so quick?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Why is it going so fast? I want it I've become very jaded now. I want the long narrative all the time. I'm really spoiled. So I don't care if you make it a million words. If they cut it into three parts, I don't care. I'll buy them all.
Yeah. Well, I want to be very careful because I don't, again, I don't want to even give the illusion of artificially extending something just to keep it going. I want to write the book the length it needs to be.
Yeah,
but if it starts to stretch toward the three book range, then I have to step back and say, Brandon, I think you may just be adding too much of your own to this. Mm-hmm. And at that point, so I don't want to let it get near that level anyway. And beyond that, knowing where I've broken it and where we're starting, I mean, there wouldn't be any other good breaking points. So I'm actually kind of hesitant to even talk about it as two books because Jim wanted it as one book so much. And I want to think of it as I'm writing one book. And if they decide to take half that book at the climactic moment and publish it while I'm working on the second half, well, so be it then. That's what the publisher gets to do. But in my head, it's going to be one book. But at the same time, you've got, you know, the latest Wheel of Time books have all felt like one book. Starting with really Crown of Swords, I feel like it's become one long story rather than, you know, the early ones felt much more delineated. This is Great Hunt. We're chasing the horn. We're, you know, beginning, middle, right. End. Here we are. Later books don't feel like that, and so they feel like a single volume. So I hope that'll make it have this last one have the same feel, even if it does get cut into two, that it's part of the whole. It's not just an individual story.
Yeah. No, you could pick up, you know, Wheel of Time or Great Hunt and just almost read it as its own.
Yeah, novel. Yeah.
You couldn't do that with Knife of Dreams. You
no,
know
no.
Where to start,
no.
You know? You'd be lost.
Yeah, you could even do that with Dragon Reborn.
Yeah.
And at Shadow Rising, it really would get hard. At that point, I kind of see the books as the initial trilogy and then the second trilogy, which is actually contains a lot of my favorite parts. Mm-hmm. It's books 4, 5, and 6, but there's still a lot of great parts later on. And then 7 through 11 are one book almost, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So,
do you think when he wrote the first one, did he have an idea that it would be continuing on? I mean, did he have a contract?
I talked to Tom Doherty because I've always wondered this. Tom said that he signed on for 6. That's what Tom said. And it seems like, Jim had been working on this book, this series, for a long time. I mean, what Tom said is that at about book 6 or 7 is when they caught up to what Jim had already been writing. Mm-hmm. So up until book 6, it seems like he already had, like he was ahead until then. He'd already, seems like he'd, I didn't ask specifically, but it seems like he had several books done when they published the first one. And that's probably why, didn't Eye of the World and Great Hunt come out the same year? Like January and November. And so the same calendar year, they were separated by like 10 months or something like that. But that's why I think that happened, that then we got one a year for a while, is because he already had them completed or, you know, and had all that. And then at book 6, that's when we caught up to him and he had to write. And that's why I think Crown of Swords took longer. A lot of people complained about it then, but then they also complained about the length. And it's like, which way do you want it?
Yeah,
you're
really
going to complain about him that it's taking so long, but then if you were going to take the length that it needed to be, you complain even more. And so anyway, but I think that's what happened there. People noticed the transition there, and I think by book 6, he knew that he had as much time as he wanted to tell the story. But before then, he didn't necessarily know. And it seems like he had the proposal he went to Tom had delineated books for books 1 through 6, which is why they all feel like more of an individual book. And then at book 7, he was able to just to make it explode. And so that's what I've been able to piece together. I may not be right on that because I don't think, you know, everyone seems to have a slightly different story about how all this happened. And I think they're all just kind of surprised because we all want books to take off, but books don't. I mean, here's an example of how big the Wheel of Time was. My latest book, the third Mistborn book, Hero of Ages, came out last week. We hit the New York Times bestseller list for the first time. We hit the USA Today bestseller list. It, by sales, it looks like it will probably be the best-selling fantasy book that Tor releases this year.
Cool.
Robert Jordan's latest book sold 20 times what Hero of Ages did in its first week.
Wow.
20 times. Then, and my book's going to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, fantasy book tour releases this year. And so Robert Jordan was 20 times ahead of the people who were close to him, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's how important, how wonderful these books were.
Yeah.
How they went to a much larger audience. People who don't read fantasy read The Wheel of Time because these books, they're special. Books like this don't come along that often, if that makes sense. I don't know it's just multiples and multiples and multiples beyond the things that were chasing it. So
sort of like Secretariat leaving the field behind by 30
yeah.
lengths.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Happens.
Yeah, yeah.
It just doesn't happen in that kind of a race. It's amazing. I had no idea it was that big.
Yeah,
of a race.
And I don't know the sales numbers for a lot of other people. I know Robert Jordan's. I know mine.
Yeah.
And I know enough to know that my book has outsold pretty much everything else.
Yeah.
But even that is just minuscule. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Minuscule compared to The Wheel of Time.
We knew it had to be more widely popular than many because, I mean, how often do you see any fantasy book getting to be,
number one?
Times bestseller list at all.
Yeah, I hit number 21, which is fantastic for a fantasy book because we don't hit, that's meaning epic fantasy. I mean, of course, the vampire things and some of these things, they do their own thing, and I'm happy they're doing so well.
Yeah.
Enjoy reading them if you do, but I'm an epic fantasy guy. We don't hit these lists very often.
No.
And so, and 21 is considered, wow, I can't believe we did that. Robert Jordan did number one. The last three books were number one, which is just mind-blowing.
Oh, wow. Especially to me, I'm still in a generation where science fiction was it, and fantasy was like, oh, fantasy?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you read that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
okay. And now it's become a lot more accepted.
Yeah,
much more palatable to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you need to get those numbers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you just need to have a really, really good accessible book. Wheel of Time is wonderful in that, like I said, it appeals to a lot of different people because he could write so many different varied viewpoints so well, and he wrote characters so well that people who wouldn't normally approach a fantasy book because they have a steep learning curve, they're hard to read because you have to learn a whole new world and things like this, who wouldn't approach that can identify and connect so well with the characters that it doesn't matter. They're reading and loving the characters, and that's what I think made it work, was that just absolutely wonderful characters and really lush, wonderful setting mixed together.
Absolutely.
That was exactly my experience with Wheel of Time, is that I had never picked up a fantasy novel before, and somebody recommended it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of a lot of time on my hands, and I thought, hey, I should read something really long. And Wheel of Time was suggested because it was long, and within the first few chapters, I was absolutely addicted, and I have literally read it continuously since then. So for the past, 7 years, I can't read anything else because I can't be away from Wheel of Time long enough before I'm like, it is like you miss your friends. Like, you haven't seen them in a while.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go, spend time with the characters.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Yeah. I'll sandwich in another series or a couple of books here and there, but, generally, it's like you start it and you finish the last one, and you wait a few weeks and pick up the first one again. It's kind of obsessive, really. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same with me.
Do that, because I don't think that's typical with books. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the same sort of thing I do. I mean, I've got a fancy-smancy phone, and I've bought the e-books and put them on my phone, so that way if I ever need something to read, because I'm a compulsive reader, first thing I do is I look up, okay, what book am I on and where do I want to start today? And I'll just randomly pick up one of the Wheel of Time books and start reading.
Yeah.
Going back just a few minutes ago there, Brandon, you were talking about how some of the later books were your favorites. Was there any scenes or small story arcs that jump out, on a whim as your absolute favorite story arc or scene or mini subplot?
Yeah. Okay.
All the books that are out there.
All the books that are out there, my favorite section of writing is Rand in Ruidian. Rand seeing the history of the Aiel and living through it is probably my favorite sequence. A very close second would be when Lon, that's what I thought.
I always said Lan, but they corrected me.
When Lon saves Nynaeve, you know, when the whole balefire thing and the boats and stuff like that. That moment has always been, since the first time I read that scene, been one of the most important scenes, like, in my head and in my memory. But, boy, what else? So hard to choose. I mean, I said I loved the Egwene sections out of Knife of Dreams. Some of my favorite sections in the series were in that book. When Rand cleansed the source, I mean, I was not expecting that to happen in book, that was book 9, right? I was not expecting that to happen. Yeah, book 9, Winter's Heart, yeah. I hope I don't, boy, that would, yeah, I got it right, that's good. That, but I would, you know, he was, I expected him to fail because we still had several books to go, and that was something I was expecting to happen. But it, so I really enjoyed that sequence, particularly with, you know, the fighting off the Forsaken and everyone kind of converging. So there's that, and boy, what else?
Are there any scenes that come to mind that are ones that you don't look forward to reading, or they're, they
out of the last book? Oh, and when you're reading.
Yeah,
when I'm reading.
In general, when you realize, oh, I'm coming up
to this. Egwene being captured by the Seanchan just is kind of painful to read. And so, in fact, it's not really that long. I think I posted in my my blog post when I was reading through that. I remember there being a whole book of her being captured and tortured by the Seanchan. And then I get there, and it's like 3 chapters. I'm like, oh, that's it? And every time I read through, it's like that.
I'm like,
oh, she's going to get captured, and oh, it's so bad. And so there's that. You know, losing Moiraine is never a pleasant experience. Particularly this last time around, because I was really identifying with her. I was finally in the position of the kind of older adult saying, no, listen, you stupid teenage boys, don't be stupid teenage boys, because it's going to come back to bite you. And lo and behold, it does. But so there's that. Anything else? A lot of people, you know, and I posted this on my blog, a lot of people didn't really like Crossroads that much. I enjoy it quite a bit, but that's probably because I like seeing how we put the book together and doing a parallel novel like that. I always enjoyed the parallel novels. And, you know, Ender's Shadow is a great parallel novel, and I enjoyed reading that. I look at Crossroads of Twilight the same way. So a lot of people say, oh, that's the big boring one that I don't like. I enjoy reading it. So I don't know. I'll say those two and leave it there. Those are two scenes that are, you know, yeah.
What do you think was the biggest surprise to you as you were going through the books? What event do you think kind of went, whoa, I didn't expect that?
That it was the cleansing, definitely. Completely unexpected. Even though he really foreshadowed and set it up, I'm like, oh, it's not going to work. And
Moiraine kept saying, oh, he'll never manage.
Yeah, and then he did it. So there's that. I didn't expect Moiraine to die the first time I was reading through. When Rand gets captured and stuffed in the box, that was unexpected.
And
one of the great sequences of the book, though, and it is. So, yeah, I guess one I don't look forward to is I don't look forward to hitting, it's book 3, isn't it, where Rand kind of goes a little bit wonky on us,
yeah.
And the other characters are chasing him down, and we don't really get to empathize with Rand for a while in that book, and then he kind of comes back in book 4, and he's changed, but we get him back as a character. It seems like in book 3, Rand is just so distraught and things that we don't really get to see him. I once read an interview, and maybe you guys have read the same one, that someone was, well, it wasn't even with Jim, it was someone talking about it. I think it was Bob Klutz, and he was mentioning that Jim saw Rand's transformation from book 2 to 3 kind of like Jim's own transformation when he went to the war. And so he backed off from it and didn't really write a lot of it because it was so personal and just so traumatic. Rand realizing that he had to be a killer is really what happened there. And so that sequence, I really enjoy that one. I don't look forward to reading that book, those sections of it, because I miss the Rand from book 1 and 2. And then by book 4, I'm happy to have the Rand of book 4, and I enjoy reading about him there. But
he really goes through some amazing transformations.
Yeah, yeah.
I think one of the biggest plot surprises to me were all the alliances between all of the parties with the Seanchan.
Yeah,
I wasn't expecting that to happen, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I just bought the
they're
the villains.
They're the villains.
Thinker,
yeah. I really like the Seanchan that he, you know, because he introduces them as, here are these new villains, and they really, it's much more muddy than that, and I really love it when that happens. It works really well. They work in a lot of ways. Like in Lord of the Rings, you've got Sauron, the big faceless evil, and then you've got Gollum, the what do you do with this? Not quite so evil, not quite, you know.
Yeah.
And the Shan-Chan are that for me in the Wheel of Time books, the really interesting, fascinating antagonist who's not necessarily a villain. So.
Yeah, that works on a lot of levels, I think, to me. I don't know. I guess one of the only other painful parts to me, I got really tired of Fael.
Okay.
And the ongoing.
See, I was tired of ongoing rescue. The only place I got tired of Fael was in what was it? Was it book three where she's going with Perrin through the ways?
Oh.
And how she treats him.
That's in four.
Is it in four? Okay.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. The way that's the only time I can really remember being annoyed and mad with Fael. I'm more in the later books, kind of more a little bit annoyed. It's not Fael, it's Perrin I'm a little bit annoyed with. I'm like, just get on with it. Come on. You know? But of course he couldn't, but you know what I mean. So. I like Fael. I think she's great.
I like her too, but I just please just rescue her or
yeah.
stop talking about it or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, I don't think I could have read him saying, you know, he's the hammer and the anvil and, oh my God, Fael, another day, another notch. I was just like, please.
Well, that's all over now.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
That's
great. And then the thing that amazes me, and I've said this on the podcast many times, is that for books and books, this situation is developing and happening and everything, and then all of a sudden, he resolves it in like a paragraph,
mm-hmm.
like Roland.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that was another surprising one.
Yeah.
Man.
Here's this whole relationship going, and
yeah.
then it's like, oh, he's dead. That's it. Bye.
Yeah.
I was like, wait.
Yeah.
Wasn't there more? I was surprised. That really shocked me. I'm
yeah.
like, okay.
Yeah, that was. That was really a surprising moment.
I really thought there'd be some more confrontation
yeah.
between
yeah.
maybe
or
Perrin
I thought
and
maybe
Roland
he was
or...
setting up that, you know, we'll bring Roland along or he'll
yeah.
be like, no, gone.
Gone.
Whoa, okay.
Hammer time.
Yeah.
You're out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I guess at that point he might have started realizing that he had to start dealing with some of these characters
yeah.
because he just had so many of
yep.
them.
Yep, yep.
Didn't have to start eliminating them somehow or another, but I thought that was a little abrupt.
Yeah.
I will say that going into book 12, and I can't reveal anything about book 12, but I can reveal my thoughts before I read any of the notes. Going into it, there one thing I wanted to see was a little bit more of an aftermath or a resolution. Not see Roland again, but I wanted to see what Fael's reaction was and these sorts of things. I was hoping for some moments of just thought on her part to kind of deal with that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of the questions I was going to ask is, do you think that there's going to be time to provide some sort of resolution for a lot of these minor characters?
I think there will be.
Yeah.
My goal is to,
two,
yeah,
you know?
My goal is to add as much of that as the outline allows me and the story allows me to do. Like, another one I really want to see, and again, I can't promise that this is actually in the book or not, but one I really want to see a reunion between Tam and Rand.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we've been waiting for it for books and books and books.
So close.
And they're so close. And so I've that's one thing I wanted to see. And so, you know, there are a lot of these little – and Tam really is a side character. He's a minor character, even though he's so important in a lot of ways. He's a side character. These characters I want to see what happens. And Bael Dohmann is – yeah.
I
mean,
Bael.
I love him, and he's been around since the early days. Like, he was in the first book, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he just keeps showing up and, you know, just get pulled into things that he's not expecting. And so
Andrew called him a glue character. He's
yeah.
like one of those plot-driving glue characters that sort of manages to stitch a lot of strange
yeah.
things together and make it work.
Well, and oh, I'm going to... Hurin? Is
yeah.
that how I say his name?
Yeah.
Sniffer.
The
Sniffer. What happened to him? What, you know, some of these... Yeah.
Back to Shinar, and that's
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah. Bye-bye. But, you know, some of these people,
That's the fun. There's so many of these characters.
Yeah.
I mean, what are there, 1,600 characters
yeah.
in there? And so many of them are not only interesting, but they're just memorable characters,
yeah.
even
yeah.
though they're fairly minor
mm-hmm.
in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
He manages to give that humanity, if you will, or
yeah,
or
to even just
level.
People you meet for just a moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're, just, even some of the traitors that are going
yeah.
by, he manages to flesh them out to where you can actually remember them, you
yeah.
know?
What always surprises me is when they reappeared.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Months later,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You never even realized that
like,
was the same
like
person.
Like, Bayar. I didn't realize until, like, several times read through that, wait a minute, that's that same guy showing up all the time, the white cloak, and,
yeah,
you know.
Jared,
just,
or whatever,
yeah.
Jared,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other fellow that was, Bail Bowman kicked him off his boat. I can't think of his name right now.
Lauren
Gelb.
Yeah,
yeah. He shows up later on giving item to Deanan.
Uh-huh.
Probably butchering all these names.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we need to. We definitely need to. Maybe you can ask the Maria and Alan, is it? Maybe they would come on the podcast and just talk to us about how to pronounce some of these names.
Yeah, maybe we should
get
Maria on.
We could do a call-in or something.
Yeah. But we're running a little low on time.
I wouldn't want to say anything because I don't want to
probably wrap it up because if we're going to do lunch and I need to be to Burbank by 4,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So we would like to say thank you
very
much
for
taking the time to
absolutely.
Come and talk with us.
Yeah.
We appreciate it. Your
yep.
insights are wonderful.
Yeah, well, and if people want to, I mean, my blog's on brandonsanderson.com. I've got lots of little posts and things and stuff like that, and so if they want to stop by, they can see into my mind more if they really feel like doing it.
Well, I love that because I think it makes you one of the most accessible of all the authors.
I try.
You give us an insight into what you're doing, and you give us a progress bar. And so, I mean, we feel like you're really including us in the experience.
Hasn't moved a lot lately. I'm sorry about that. I warned people that I had to really work hard August, September, because I knew October was just going to be dreadful. I had a rewrite due on another book, and I can't toss that aside. I'm contractually bound to do it. And then I have the book tour where I'm trying to find time to write on things, but really what I've been doing is rereading Knife of Dreams because now it's been – I mean, I finished Knife of Dreams last in March, and now starting over and doing a new viewpoint, you know, I'm feeling a little rusty already. And so I've got to reread Knife of Dreams just to get me back into it and remind me of some of these things that I need, you know. Anyway, so that's what I've been doing most of the time recently. That's why the progress bar has been moving up like 1% a week or things like that. So.
I still think it's amazing, though, when you consider the level of complexity of the task that you've been set. And it's astonishing. I just have to say one of the projects that I'm looking forward to seeing is Warbreaker.
Thanks.
You put that on the website. I think that's probably my favorite so far.
Oh, well, thank you.
I
hope to get better with each book, honestly. That's kind of my goal. And so, Warbreaker, free for download on my website at brandonsanderson.com. It's coming out next summer in hardcover, but I decided I wanted to put it out. People who read my books, I feel, you know, people who read fantasy, a lot of us are just, we love the genre, we love the books. And buying the books is not about reading them. It's about having them. And so I feel, you know, giving a book away for free, I'm perfectly happy to do that. Enjoy the book. Read it. And, you know, you could get it from the library. There are lots of ways to get the book and not buy it. The people who are going to buy it are the people who are going to buy it and want to have it. And so I don't, you know, I hope to release more books for free on my website eventually.
I love that because we can read them, but then we're a lot like oil. You know, we have to cart them around with us, too, because you have to have it with us.
Yeah.
You can't really take a PDF with you everywhere.
It's also nice that I felt that releasing at least one book on my website, a good one, like a new one I was working on, not something that I dug out of the trunk, would be a nice calling card for people who a lot of people, particularly with the Wheel of Time news, are like, who is this Brandon guy? And a lot of skeptical eyebrows raise, rightly so. I'm fairly new to this. I think I was chosen for my love of the series and hopefully my writing skill and not the fact that I have a lot of books published. And so I wanted to release one that people could just come and give me a try without having to spend any money on it. Because, you know, I would rather if someone doesn't like the book, at least then they haven't spent any money on it. And different books for different people. Different people will like different things. And it's okay if someone doesn't like one of my books or if they don't like, you know, that's perfectly all right. At least you didn't spend money on it. And I think that you read it and you didn't spend money on it, you're like, oh, that's fine. But if you read it and you bought it for $30, and you're like, oh, man, I wasted my – so I wanted at least one that people could try out. And it is a standalone, so I also like that you can just read one book and see what I'm like and have an ending. And even, you know, you don't have to get into another big series to try out one of my books. So.
I really like the magic system that you came up with in that, the colors. And I love that. And I have to say, the Alamance in Mistborn is hard for me to relate to.
Okay.
I don't know why, but it's like, I guess I've just spent too much time in the Wheel of Time, you know,
yeah,
where it's sort of
yeah.
like an inborn thing that you can
right.
draw on. It seems hard for me to get into the burning of metals and things like that, but it's still a fascinating series of books. You know,
okay.
there's something for everybody in all of them, you know, so I'm glad that you're doing it. I'm just, and you know, the other thing is I'm really, really excited that you're such a fan too. I love that. I can geek out over
over the minor characters with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, we're really grateful. We don't want to keep you any longer. I know you've been very gracious with your time, and thank you so much for letting us intrude into your book tour.
Thank you guys. You know, we get to do things like this, be writers like this, because of people like you. People like you buying our books and not just reading them once, but reading them again, making them part of your lives. You are our employers.
That's one way to look at it.
You and without you, I would have to go be an insurance salesman or something like that. Because of you, I get to tell stories, sit at home and come up with stories. And so I'm indebted to all of you. And the Wheel in Time fans have been fantastic. And, you know, I worried that I would get tons of hate mail, but they've been very accepting. You know, it's sometimes hesitant acceptance. It's, I hope you do a good job. You'd better do a good job, but I wish you the best of luck. That's kind of, I think, the right response. So they've been wonderful.
I'm glad that you feel that way. We're just so glad that there's somebody taking on the task and that it's not going to just evaporate into nothingness. I know you said you didn't think in the world of publishing that would happen, but,
right.
you know, it could have been 20 years.
It could have been, and it could have, your rights could have gotten tied up, or they could have, you know, and so, or they could have gotten somebody who would have made a lot of demands. Or things like this. I mean, we got, they called and, oh, we really need, but anyway, they called and offered it, and I called my agent, and I said, whatever they offer, take the deal. He's like, well, we should negotiate, and I'm like, no, you don't understand.
Yeah.
Whatever they offer, we take the deal as is. I want it signed in a week. And so.
After you pick yourself up off
yeah,
the wall,
yeah,
oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, this, you know, I would have done this for no money and no credit, and I told him that. I said, you know, just say yes. And fortunately, the contract was very good and very respectful and, you know, all of these things. But I would have done it for nothing. This is not something you pass up. So.
What was it? One of the characters, I think, I can't even remember now, something about, you're not much on negotiating, are you?
Yeah.
No, this is different. It's
yeah, this
saying.
Is different. This is, you don't argue. You don't argue on this.
Well, we're just glad that you're taking on the task. And again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
This is Virginia and Jesse and Mark saying goodbye for the Fourth Age podcast. And thank you again to Brandon.
Yes, thanks again for coming out, for being with us, and for answering our sometimes too prying of questions there, Brandon. It's been extremely enlightening.
No problem.
It's been great. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
Well, once again, thank you for joining us, Brandon. It's been a true pleasure getting to speak with you. I would just like to say for myself, Andrew Gellos, Ravianinto, Monskima, Ashite.